sweeping the beautiful damsel Alsace off her feet into a rapturous embrace. A proclamation addressed to the inhabitants had already been printed by the War Ministry, ready for posting on the walls of liberated towns. Airplane reconnaissance showed the area to be lightly held, almost too lightly, thought General Bonneau, commander of the 7th Corps, who feared he was walking into a mousetrap. He sent an aide on the evening of August 6 to report to General Dubai that he considered the Malouz operation delicate and hazardous and was concerned for his right flank and rear. GQG, consulted by Dubai, who had expressed similar concern at the meeting of generals on August 3, regarded all doubts as failure of the offensive spirit. Expressed at the start of an operation, a commander's doubts, however valid, too often proved a formula for retreat. In French military doctrine, seizure of the initiative was more important than careful appreciation of enemy strength. Success depended upon the fighting qualities of commanders, and to permit caution and hesitation to take hold at the outset would, in the view of Joffre and his entourage, have been ruinous. GQG insisted upon the attack in Alsace being launched as soon as possible. Obeying, Dubai called General Bonneau on the telephone, asked if he was ready, and on receiving an affirmative answer, ordered the attack for next morning. At 5 o'clock on the morning of August 7, a few hours before Ludendorff led his brigade into Liège, General Bonneau's 7th Corps spilled over the crest of the Vosges, presenting arms as they crossed the frontier, and swept down in a classic bayonet charge upon Altkirch, a town of about 4,000 on the way to Malouz. They took Altkirch by assault in a battle lasting 6 hours with 100 casualties. It was not the last bayonet charge of a war whose symbol was soon to be a mud-filled trench, but it might as well have been. Executed in the finest style and spirit of the Règlement of 1913, it seemed the proof of cran, the apotheosis of La Gloire. The hour, as the French communique reported, was one of indescribable emotion. Frontier posts were torn from the ground and carried in triumph through the town. But General Bonneau, still uneasy, did not push on toward Malouz. Impatient at his lack of progress, GQG, on the following morning, issued an imperative order that Malouz be taken and the Rhine bridges destroyed that day. On August 8, the 7th Corps entered Malouz without firing a shot, about an hour after the last German troops, withdrawn to defend the frontier farther north, had left it. The French cavalry in gleaming cuirasses and black horsehair plumes galloped through the streets. Almost dumbfounded at the sudden apparition, the people stood at first transfixed in silence or sobbing, then gradually broke into joy. A grand review of the French troops lasting 2 hours was held in the main square. The bands played the Marseillaise and the Sambre et Meuse. Guns were hung with flowers of red, white, and blue, Joffre's proclamation vaunting his soldiers as the vanguard of the great work of revanche, who carry in the folds of their flags the magic words right and liberty, was posted on the walls. Chocolates, pastries, and pipes of tobacco were thrust upon the soldiers. From all the windows flags and handkerchiefs waved, and even the roofs were covered with people. Not all were welcomers. Many of the inhabitants were Germans who'd settled there since 1870. One officer riding through the crowds noticed among them grave and impassive faces, pipe in teeth, who looked as if they were counting us. As indeed they were, and afterwards hastened away during the night to report on the strength of the French divisions. German reinforcements, hurriedly sent from Strasbourg, were deployed around the city while the French were busy occupying it. General Bonneau, who lacked faith in success from the start, had made what dispositions he could to prevent envelopment. When battle began on the morning of August 9, his left at Cernay fought fiercely and stubbornly all day, but his right, holding too long to an unthreatened sector, was not brought around in time. Finally recognizing the necessity of reinforcements which had worried Dubai from the start, GQG sent up a reserve division, but at this stage, to solidify the front, two would have been required. For 24 hours the battle swayed, until 7 a.m. on August 10, when the French, pushed back and fearing to be enveloped, withdrew. Humiliating as it was to the army after the glorious rhetoric of the communiques and proclamations and the accumulated yearning of 44 years, the loss of Mulhouse was cruelest upon the inhabitants, who were now left subject to German reprisals. Those who had been most enthusiastic in welcoming the French were informed upon by their German fellow citizens, with unpleasant consequences. The 7th Corps retreated to within 10 miles of Belfort. At GQG, the natural and eternal enmity of staff officers for field officers flared. Confirmed in his belief of Bonneau's lack of cran, Joffre began the role of heads, for which his regime was to become famous. General Bonneau became the first of the Limogés, so-called because officers relieved of their commands reported at Limoges for Rio duty. Blaming faulty execution, Joffre, within 3 days, also dismissed the commander of the 8th Cavalry and another general of division. Intent upon the original plan of freeing Alsace and pinning German forces to that front, and without regard for reports coming out of Belgium, Joffre took 1 regular and 3 reserve divisions and added them to the 7th Corps to form a special army of Alsace for renewed action on his extreme right. General Poe was called out of retirement to command it. During the 4 days while it was assembling, heavy pressures were building up elsewhere. On August 14, the day Poe was to move forward, 30 storks were seen flying south over Belfort, leaving Alsace 2 months before their usual time. The French nation was hardly aware of what had happened. GQG's bulletins were masterpieces of the opaque. Joffre operated on the fixed principle that civilians should be told nothing. No journalists were allowed at the front, no names of generals or of casualties or of regiments were mentioned. In order to keep all useful information from the enemy, GQG adopted a principle from the Japanese to wage war silently and anonymously. France was divided into a zone of the rear and a zone of the armies. In the latter, Joffre was absolute dictator. No civilian, not even the president, much less the despised deputies, could enter it without his permission. It was his and not the president's name that was signed to the proclamation addressed to the people of Alsace. Ministers protested that they knew more of the movements of the German armies than of the French. Poincaré, to whom Joffre, considering himself independent of the Minister of War, reported directly, complained he was never told about reverses. On one occasion, when a presidential visit to the Third Army was proposed, Joffre issued strict orders to its commander not to discuss with the president any question of strategy or foreign policy. A report of the conversation must be submitted. All his generals were cautioned against explaining military operations to members of the government. "In the reports I forward," Joffre told them, "I never make known the object of my current operations or my intentions." His system was soon to break down under rising public pressure. But in August, when frontiers fell and nations were invaded and vast armies swayed in what was still a war of movement, and the earth shook under the thud of war from Serbia to Belgium, hard news from the front was rare indeed. History, while it was happening in that month, despite 1,000 eager chroniclers, was not easily pinned down. General Gallieni, dining in civilian clothes at a small café in Paris on August 9, overheard an editor of Le Temps at the next table say to a companion, "I can tell you that General Gallieni has just entered Colmar with 30,000 men." Leaning over to his friend, Gallieni said quietly, "That is how history is written." While the Germans at Liège waited for the siege guns, while the world marvelled at the continued resistance of the forts, and the London Daily Mail quoted a consensus of opinion that they could never be taken, while the assembling of the armies continued, some men waited in acute anxiety for the pattern of the German offensive to reveal itself. General Gallieni was one. "What is happening behind the German front?" he wondered. "What massive concentration is gathering behind Liège? With the Germans, one must always expect the gigantic." The answer to this question was what the French cavalry under General Sordet had been sent to find out. Yet so impetuous was the dash of the cuirassiers that it carried them too far, too soon. They crossed into Belgium on August 6, riding along the Meuse to reconnoitre the strength and direction of the German concentration. Covering 110 miles in 3 days, nearly 40 miles a day, they passed Neufchâteau and reached within 9 miles of Liège. As the French did not dismount or unsaddle during halts, the horses were exhausted by the forced pace. After a day's rest, the cavalry continued their reconnaissance in the Ardennes and west of the Meuse as far as Charleroi. But everywhere, they were too early to find evidence that the Germans had crossed the Meuse in any great strength. And everywhere, active German cavalry screened the concentration of the armies building up behind the German border. The French found themselves foiled of the thrilling cavalry charge that was the traditional way to open wars. Although farther north, where they were on the offensive toward Louvain and Brussels, the German cavalry used the shock tactics of the charge, here they avoided a direct fight and kept up an impenetrable screen, supported by cyclist battalions and Jägers in motor transport, who held off the French with machine gun fire. It was disheartening. Cavalrymen on both sides still believed in the naked sword, the arme blanche, despite the experience of the American Civil War, when Confederate General Morgan, employing his men as mounted infantry with rifles, would cry, "Here, boys, are those fools coming again with their sabers? Give it to them!" In the Russo-Japanese War, an English observer, the future General Sir Ian Hamilton, reported that the only thing the cavalry could do in the face of entrenched machine guns was to cook rice for the infantry, causing the War Office to wonder if his months in the Orient had not affected his mind. When Germany's observer in the same war, the future General Max Hoffmann, reported a similar conclusion about the defensive power of entrenched machine guns, Moltke was inspired to comment, "There never was such a crazy way of making war." In 1914, the Germans' avoidance of cavalry encounter and their use of machine guns provided an effective screen. Soldé's reports of no large German masses coming down on the French left confirmed GQG in its preconceived ideas. But the outlines of a German right-wing envelopment were already becoming clear to King Albert and General Lanrezac, who, being in its path, were more disposed to see it. Another of these was General Fournier, governor of the French fortress of Maubeuge. He informed GQG that German cavalry on August 7 had entered Uy on the Meuse, and that his reports indicated they were covering an advance of 5 or 6 corps. As Uy was the site of the only bridge between Liège and Namur, this enemy force was obviously intending to cross the Meuse. Maubeuge, its governor warned, was in no condition to resist such numbers. To GQG, the report of 5 or 6 corps appeared as the frightened exaggeration of a defeatist mind. Weeding out the faint-hearted was, for Joffre, in August, the most vital requirement for success, and he promptly relieved General Fournier of his command. Later, after an investigation, the order was rescinded. Meanwhile, it was discovered that it would take at least a fortnight to put Maubeuge in any state of effective defence. The anxiety of General Lanrezac, who had also received the report from Uy, was increasing. On August 8, he sent his chief of staff, General Elie Doissel, to impress the threat of a German right-wing outflanking movement upon GQG. General Lanrezac's concern was premature, GQG replied, because such a movement was out of proportion to the means at the enemy's disposal. Further evidence from Belgium kept coming in, but for each report, the chapel of Plan 17 found an explanation. The brigades seen at Uy were on some special mission, or the sources of information were suspicious. The attack on Liège had for its object nothing more than seizure of a bridgehead there. On August 10, GQG felt confirmed in the impression that the principal German manoeuvre would not take place in Belgium. Committed to its own coming offensive, the French general staff wanted to make sure that the Belgian army would stand fast until it could be joined by the Fifth Army and the British. Joffre sent another emissary, Colonel Adelbert, with a personal letter from Poincaré to King Albert, hoping for concerted action by both armies. This officer, who reached Brussels on August 11, received the same answer as his predecessors, that if a German advance straight across Belgium developed, as the king foresaw, he would not permit his army to risk being cut off from Antwerp. Colonel Adalbert, an ardent apostle of élan, could not bring himself to transmit the king's pessimism to GQG. He was saved the necessity by a battle next day from which the Belgians emerged, drenched in glory. The Uhlans, penetrating toward Louvain, were held up at the bridge at Hallen by the massed fire of Belgian cavalry under General de Vita. Using his troops as dismounted riflemen supported by infantry, de Vita repeated General Morgan's success in Tennessee. From 8 in the morning until 6 in the evening, his steady volleys of rifle fire repelled repeated German charges with lance and sabre. Slaughtered Uhlans of von Marwitz's finest squadrons covered the ground until at last a remnant turned back, leaving the field to the Belgians. The glorious victory, heralded by happy correspondents in Brussels as the decisive battle of the war, aroused the Belgian staff and its French friends to transports of enthusiasm. They saw themselves in Berlin. Colonel Adalbert informed GQG it could regard the retreat of the German cavalry as final and the projected attack through central Belgium as postponed or even abandoned. The optimism seemed justified by the continuing stand of the Liège forts. Every morning, Belgian newspapers published the triumphant headline, Les Forts Tiennent Toujours. On August 12, the same day as the Battle of Hallen, the great siege guns the Germans had been waiting for to put an end to that post arrived. Liège was cut off from the outside world. When the great black weapons reached the outskirts within range of the forts, only the local inhabitants saw the advent of the monsters that to one observer looked like overfed slugs. Their squat barrels, doubled by the recoil cylinders that grew on their backs like tumours, pointed cavernous mouths upward at the sky. By late afternoon of August 12, one of them had been set up and aimed at Fort Pontis. Its crew, wearing padding over eyes, ears and mouths, lay flat on their stomachs ready for the firing, which was done electrically at a distance of 300 yards. At 6:30, the first detonation thundered over Liège. The shell rose in an arc 4,000 feet high and took 60 seconds to reach its target. When it hit, a great conical cloud of dust, debris and smoke rose 1,000 feet in the air. Meanwhile, the Skoda 305s had also been brought up and began bombardment of other forts, walked in upon their targets by artillery observers stationed in church towers and balloons. Men of the Belgian garrisons heard the shells descending with a screaming whistle, felt the detonations coming each time more nearly overhead as the aiming was corrected, until, as their terror mounted, the shells exploded upon them with deafening crash and the solid steel heads smashed through the concrete. Over and over the shells came, blowing men to bits, choking them with fumes released by the charge of high explosives. Ceilings fell in, galleries were blocked, fire, gas and noise filled the underground chambers. Men became hysterical, even mad, in the awful apprehension of the next shot. Before the guns went into action, only one fort had been taken by assault. Fort Pontis withstood 45 shells in 24 hours of bombardment before it was sufficiently shattered to be taken by infantry attack on August 13. Two more forts fell that day, and by the 14th, all the forts east and north of the city had fallen. Their guns were destroyed, the roads north of the city were open. The advance of von Kluck's First Army began. The siege mortars were then moved forward to be trained on the western forts. One of the 420s was dragged through the city itself to take aim on Fort Lancin. Monsieur Célestin Demblon, deputy of Liège, was in the Place Saint-Pierre when he saw coming around the corner of the square a piece of artillery so colossal that we could not believe our eyes. The monster advanced in two parts, pulled by 36 horses. The pavement trembled. The crowd remained mute with consternation at the appearance of this phenomenal apparatus. Slowly it crossed the Place Saint-Lambert, turned into the Place du Théâtre, then along the boulevards de la Servinière and d'Avroy, attracting crowds of curious onlookers along its slow and heavy passage. Hannibal's elephants could not have astonished the Romans more. The soldiers who accompanied it marched stiffly with an almost religious solemnity. It was the Belial of cannons. In the Parc d'Avroy it was carefully mounted and scrupulously aimed. Then came the frightful explosion. The crowd was flung back. The earth shook like an earthquake, and all the window panes in the vicinity were shattered. By August 16, 11 of the 12 forts had fallen. Only Fort Longsin still held out. In the intervals of bombardment, the Germans sent emissaries under flags of truce to demand General Le Mans' surrender. He refused. On the 16th, Longsin was hit by a shell which exploded in the magazine and blew up the fort from inside. When the Germans entered through a tumble of broken cupolas and smoking concrete, they found the apparently lifeless body of General Le Mans pinned beneath a block of masonry. "Respect the general, he is dead," said an adjutant with blackened face who stood guard over the body. Le Mans was, however, alive but unconscious. Revived and carried to General von Emmich, he surrendered his sword, saying, "I was taken unconscious. Be sure to put that in your dispatches." "Military honour has not been violated by your sword," replied Emmich, handing it back. "Keep it." Later, from Germany, where he was taken a prisoner, General Le Mans wrote to King Albert, "I would gladly have given my life, but death would not have me." His opponents, Generals von Emmich and Ludendorff, were both awarded the Blue, White and Gold Cross of Pour la Mérite, Germany's highest military medal, to hang around their necks. On the day after the fall of Fort Longsin, the 2nd and 3rd armies began their advance, bringing the whole mass of the German right wing into motion on its march across Belgium. As the march had not been scheduled to begin before August 15, Liège had held up the German offensive by 2 days, not 2 weeks, as the world then believed. What Belgium gave the Allies was neither 2 days nor 2 weeks, but a cause and an example. Chapter 12. BEF to the Continent. Delay in covering the exposed flank on General Lanrezac's left was caused by dispute and disagreement among the British, who were to have held that end of the line. On August 5, their first day of war, the General Staff's plan, worked out to the last detail by Henry Wilson, instead of going into action automatically like the Continental War plans, had to be approved first by the Committee of Imperial Defence. When the committee convened as a war council at 4 o'clock that afternoon, it included the usual civilian as well as military leaders, and one splendid colossus taking his seat among them for the first time, who was both. Field Marshal Lord Kitchener was no more happy to be the new Secretary of State for War than his colleagues were to have him. The government was nervous at having in their midst the first active soldier to enter the cabinet since General Monk served under Charles II. The generals were worried that he would use his position or be used by the government to interfere with the sending of an expeditionary force to France. No one's apprehensions were disappointed. Kitchener promptly expressed his profound contempt for the strategy, policy, and role assigned to the British Army by the Anglo-French plan. What exactly was to be his authority, given his position straddling two stools, was not entirely clear. England entered the war with a vague understanding that supreme authority resided in the Prime Minister, but with no precise arrangement as to whose advice he was to act on or whose advice was to be definitive. Within the army, field officers despised staff officers as having the brains of canaries and the manners of Potsdam. But both groups were as one in their distaste for interference by civilian ministers who were known as the frocks. The civil arm, in its turn, referred to the military as the boneheads. At the War Council of August 5, the former were represented by Asquith, Grey, Churchill and Haldane, and the army by 11 general officers, including Field Marshal Sir John French, Commander-in-Chief Designate of the Expeditionary Force, its 2 corps commanders, Sir Douglas Haig and Sir James Grierson, its Chief of Staff, Sir Archibald Murray, all Lieutenant Generals, and its Deputy Chief of Staff, Major General Henry Wilson, whose easy faculty for making political enemies had flourished during the Curragh crisis and lost him the higher post. In between, representing no one quite knew what, was Lord Kitchener, who regarded the purpose of the expeditionary force with deep misgivings and its commander-in-chief without admiration. If not quite as volcanic in expressing himself as Admiral Fisher had been, Kitchener now proceeded to pour the same scorn upon the general staff's plan to tack on the British army to the tail of French strategy. Having had no personal share in the military planning for war on the continent, Kitchener was able to see the expeditionary force in its true proportions, and did not believe its 6 divisions likely to affect the outcome in the impending clash between 70 German and 70 French divisions. "Though a professional soldier, the most able I've come across in my time," said Lord Cromer, when Kitchener came out to command the Khartoum campaign. His career had lately been pursued at Olympian levels. He dealt in India, Egypt, Empire, and large concepts only. He was never seen to speak to or notice a private soldier. Like Clausewitz, he saw war as an extension of policy and took it from there. Unlike Henry Wilson and the General's staff, he was not trapped in schedules of debarkation, railroad timetables, horses and billets. Standing at a distance, he was able to view the war as a whole, in terms of the relations of the powers, and to realize the immense effort of national military expansion that would be required for the long contest about to begin. "We must be prepared," he announced, "to put armies of millions in the field and maintain them for several years." His audience was stunned and incredulous, but Kitchener was relentless. To fight and win a European war, Britain must have an army of 70 divisions, equal to the Continental armies, and he had calculated that such an army would not reach full strength until the 3rd year of war, implying the staggering corollary that the war would last that long. The regular army, with its professional officers and especially its NCOs, he considered to be precious and indispensable as a nucleus for training the larger force he had in mind. To throw it away in immediate battle, under what he expected to be unfavourable circumstances, and where, from the long view, its presence could not be decisive, he regarded as criminal folly. Once it was gone, there were no troops properly trained, in his opinion, to take its place. Lack of conscription was the most striking of all differences between the British and Continental armies. The regular army was designed for overseas duty rather than for defence of the homeland, which was left to the territorials. Since the Duke of Wellington had laid down the unalterable dictum that recruits for foreign service must be volunteers, Britain's war effort consequently depended on a volunteer army, which left other nations uncertain as to how deeply Britain was or would be committed. Although Lord Roberts, the senior field marshal, now over 70, had campaigned strenuously for conscription for years, with one lone supporter in the cabinet, needless to say, Winston Churchill, Labour was rigorously opposed, and no government would have risked office to favour it. Britain's military establishment in the home islands consisted of 6 divisions and 1 cavalry division of the regular army, with 4 regular divisions totalling 60,000 men overseas and 14 divisions of territorials. A reserve of about 300,000 was divided into 2 classes, the special reserve, which was barely enough to fill up the regular army to war strength and maintain it in the field through the first few weeks of fighting, and the national reserve, which was to provide replacements for the territorials. According to Kitchener's standards, the territorials were untrained, useless amateurs, whom he regarded with the same unmixed scorn and with as little justice as the French did their reserves, and rated them at 0. At the age of 20, Kitchener had fought as a volunteer with the French army in the War of 1870 and spoke French fluently. Whether or not he had, as a result, an extra sympathy for France, he was no extreme partisan of French strategy. At the time of the Agadir crisis, he told the Committee of Imperial Defence that he expected the Germans to walk through the French like partridges, and when invited, he refused to take part in any decision the committee might think fit to take. He sent them word, as Lord Escher recorded it, that if they imagined he was going to command the army in France, he would see them damned first. That England in 1914 gave him the War Office, and thereby acquired the only man prepared to insist on organising for a long war, was not because of his opinions, but because of his prestige. With no talent for the bureaucracy of administrative office, and no taste for conforming to the green baize routine of cabinet meetings, after being accustomed to a proconsul's simple let it be done, Kitchener did his best to escape his fate. The government and generals, more conscious of his faults of character than of his virtues of clairvoyance, would have been glad to let him go back to Egypt, but they could not do without him. He was named Secretary for War not because he was considered qualified by the holding of opinions which no one else held, but because his presence was indispensable to tranquillize public feeling. Ever since Khartoum, the country had felt an almost religious faith in Kitchener. There existed between him and the public the same mystic union that was to develop between the people of France and Papa Joffre, or between the German people and Hindenburg. The initials K of K were a magic formula, and his broad, martial moustache a national symbol that was to England what the pantalon rouge was to France. Wearing its bushy magnificence with an air of power, tall and broad-shouldered, he looked like a Victorian image of Richard the Lion-hearted, except for something inscrutable behind the solemn, blazing eyes. Beginning August 7, the moustache, the eyes, and the pointing finger over the legend, "Your country needs you," were to bore into the soul of every Englishman from a famous recruiting poster. For England to have gone to war without Kitchener would have been as unthinkable as Sunday without church. The War Council, however, put little credence in his prophecy at a moment when everyone was thinking of the immediate problem of sending the 6 divisions to France. "It was never disclosed," wrote Grey long afterward, with perhaps needless bewilderment, "how or by what process of reasoning he made this forecast of the length of the war." Whether because Kitchener was right when everybody else was wrong, or because civilians found it hard to credit soldiers with ordinary mental processes, or because Kitchener was never able or never deigned to explain his reasons, all his colleagues and contemporaries assumed that he reached his conclusions, as Grey said, by some flash of instinct rather than by reasoning. Whatever the process, Kitchener also foretold the pattern of the coming German offensive west of the Meuse. This, too, he was afterward considered to have arrived at by some gift of divination, rather than by any knowledge of times and distances, according to one general staff officer. In fact, like King Albert, Kitchener saw the assault on Liège, casting ahead of it the shadow of Schlieffen's right-wing envelopment. He did not think Germany had violated Belgium and brought England in against her in order to make what Lloyd George had called just a little violation through the Ardennes. Having avoided the responsibility of the pre-war planning, he could not now propose to withhold the 6 divisions, but he saw no reason to risk their extinction at a position as far forward as Maubeuge, where he expected they would bear the full force of the invading German armies. He proposed that they concentrate instead at Amiens, 70 miles further back. Exasperated by this drastic change of plan with its appearance of timidity, the generals were confirmed in their worst expectations. The short, stocky and florid Sir John French, about to take command in the field, was keyed to a pitch of valour and combativeness. His normally apoplectic expression, combined with the tight cavalryman's stock which he affected in place of collar and tie, gave him an appearance of being perpetually on the verge of choking, as indeed he often was, emotionally if not physically. When appointed chief of the Imperial General Staff in 1912, he at once informed Henry Wilson that he intended to get the army ready for a war with Germany, which he regarded as an eventual certainty. Since then he had been nominally responsible for the joint plans with France, although in fact the French plan of campaign was practically unknown to him, as was the German. Like Joffre, he had been named head of the staff, without staff experience or study at staff college. The choice, like that of Kitchener for the War Office, was less concerned with innate qualification than with rank and reputation. On the several colonial fields of battle where Britain's military reputations had been made, Sir John had shown courage and resource, and what an authority called a practical grasp of minor tactics. In the Boer War, his exploits as a cavalry general, culminating in the romantic gallop through the Boer lines to the relief of Kimberley, earned him fame as a bold commander, willing to take risks, and a popular repute almost equal to that of Roberts and Kitchener. Since Britain's record against an untrained opponent lacking modern weapons had on the whole not been brilliant, the army was proud of and the government grateful for a hero. French's prowess, aided by social éclat, carried him far. Like Admiral Milne, he moved in the Edwardian swim. As a cavalry officer, he was conscious of belonging to the elite of the army. Friendship with Lord Esher was no handicap, and politically he was allied with the Liberals, who came to power in 1906. In 1907 he was made Inspector General. In 1908, representing the army, he accompanied King Edward on the state visit to the Tsar at Reval. In 1912 came his appointment as CIGS. In 1913 he was promoted to Field Marshal. At 62 he was the Army's second-ranking active officer after Kitchener, to whom he was junior by 2 years, although he looked older. It was generally understood that he would command the expeditionary force in the event of war. In March 1914, when the Currer Mutiny, crashing down upon army heads like Samson's Temple, caused him to resign, he seemed to have quixotically brought his career to an abrupt end. Instead, he gained added favour with the government, which believed the opposition had engineered the mutiny. "French is a trump, and I love him," wrote Grey appreciatively. 4 months later, when the crisis came, he was resurrected, and on July 30 designated to be commander-in-chief if Britain should go to war. Untrained to study, and with a mind closed to books, at least after his early successes in action, French was less renowned for mental ability than for irritability. "I don't think he's particularly clever," King George V confided in his uncle, "and he has an awful temper." Like his vis-à-vis across the Channel, French was an unintellectual soldier, with the fundamental difference that whereas Joffre's outstanding quality was solidity, French's was a peculiar responsiveness to pressures, people, and prejudices. He had, it was said, the mercurial temperament commonly associated with Irishmen and cavalry soldiers. Joffre was imperturbable in all weathers. Sir John alternated between extremes of aggressiveness in good times and of depression in bad. Impulsive and easily swayed by gossip, he had, in the opinion of Lord Esher, the heart of a romantic child. He once presented to his former chief of staff in the Boer War a gold flask inscribed as a memento of our long and tried friendship proved in sunshine and shadow. And the proved friend was the somewhat less sentimental Douglas Haig, who in August 1914 wrote in his diary, "In my own heart I know that French is quite unfit for this great command at a time of crisis in our nation's history." The knowledge in Haig's heart was not unconnected with the sense that the person best fitted for the command was himself, nor was he to rest until he obtained it. The destination, and consequently the purpose, of the BEF having been reopened by Kitchener, the council, who were in Henry Wilson's opinion mostly entirely ignorant of their subjects, fell to discussing strategy like idiots. Sir John French suddenly dragged in the ridiculous proposal of going to Antwerp, saying that as British mobilisation was behind schedule anyway, the possibility of cooperating with the Belgian army should be considered. Haig, who, like Wilson, kept a diary, trembled at the reckless way his chief undertook to change plans. Equally upset, the new CIGS, Sir Charles Douglas, said that as everything had been arranged for landings in France and French rolling stock was set aside to transport the troops forward, any shift at the last moment would have serious consequences. No problem so harassed the general staff as the unfortunate difference in capacity between French and British railroad cars. The mathematical permutations involved in transferring troops from one to the other were such as to make transport officers tremble at any threatened change of arrangements. Happily for their peace of mind, the shift to Antwerp was vetoed by Churchill, who 2 months later was to go there himself and to conceive the bold and desperate landing of 2 marine brigades and a territorial division in a last-minute vain effort to save the vital Belgian port. On August 5, however, he said the Navy could not protect the troopships over the longer route across the North Sea to the Scheldt, whereas the passage across the Strait of Dover could be guaranteed absolutely. The Navy, having had time to prepare for the Channel crossing, he argued that the moment was favourable and urged that all 6 divisions be sent at once. Haldane supported him, as did Lord Roberts. Dispute now arose over how many divisions should be sent, whether 1 or more should be retained until the territorials had further time for training, or until replacements could be brought home from India. Kitchener returned to his idea of staging at Amiens, and received support from his friend and future commander of the Gallipoli campaign, Sir Ian Hamilton, who, however, felt it was urgent for the BEF to reach there as soon as possible. Grierson spoke up for decisive numbers at the decisive point. Sir John French, most forward of the forward, suggested that we should go over at once and decide destination later. It was agreed to order transports for all 6 divisions immediately, while leaving destination to be settled until a representative of the French General Staff, sent for hurriedly at Kitchener's insistence, could arrive for further consultation on French strategy. Within 24 hours, as the result of an invasion scare that brewed up overnight, the Council changed its mind and reduced the 6 divisions to 4. News of the discussion about the strength of the BEF had leaked out. The influential Westminster Gazette, organ of the Liberals, denounced the reckless denuding of the country. From the opposite camp, Lord Northcliffe came roaring in to protest the departure of a single soldier. Although the Admiralty confirmed the conclusion of the Committee of Imperial Defence in 1909 that no serious invasion was possible, visions of hostile landings on the east coast would not vanish. To the intense disgust of Henry Wilson, Kitchener, who was now responsible for England's safety, brought home to England one division that had been scheduled to embark for France directly from Ireland, and detached 2 brigades from other divisions which he sent to guard the east coast, thus hopelessly messing up our plans. It was decided to send 4 divisions and the cavalry at once, embarkation to begin August 9, to send the 4th division later, and to keep the 6th division in England. When the council adjourned, Kitchener was under the impression, not shared by the generals, that Amiens had been agreed upon as the staging area. When Colonel Huguet arrived, hastily sent over by the French general staff, Wilson informed him of the embarkation times. Although it was hardly a matter to be kept secret from the BEF's French hosts, he incurred Kitchener's wrath and a rebuke for breach of secrecy. Wilson answered back, having, as he wrote, no intention of being bullied by Kitchener, especially when he talked such nonsense as he did today. So began, or was aggravated, a mutually cherished antipathy that was not to aid the fortunes of the BEF. Wilson, who of all the British officers had the most intimate relation with the French and the ear of Sir John French, was considered bumptious and presumptuous, and was consequently ignored by Kitchener, while in his turn Wilson professed to consider Kitchener mad and as much an enemy of England as Moltke, and instilled his iniquities into the mind of the temperamentally suspicious and excitable Commander-in-Chief. From August 6 to 10, while the Germans at Liège were waiting for the siege guns and the French were liberating and losing Mulhouse, 80,000 troops of the BEF, with 30,000 horses, 315 field guns and 125 machine guns, were assembling at Southampton and Portsmouth. Officers' swords had been freshly sharpened, in obedience to an order that prescribed sending them to the armourer's shop on the 3rd day of mobilisation, although they were never used for anything but saluting on parade. But apart from such occasional nostalgic gestures, the force, in the words of its official historian, was the best trained, best organised and best equipped British army that ever went forth to war. On August 9, embarkation began, the transports departing at intervals of 10 minutes. As each left its dock, every other ship in the harbour blew whistles and horns, and every man on deck cheered. So deafening was the noise that it seemed to one officer that General von Kluck could not fail to hear it behind Liège. However, with the Navy confident that they'd sealed off the channel from attack, there was little fear for the safety of the crossing. The transports crossed at night without escort. Waking at 4:30 in the morning, a soldier was astonished to see the whole fleet of transports, with engines stopped, floating on an absolutely glassy sea without a destroyer in sight. They were waiting for transports from other embarkation ports to complete a rendezvous in mid-channel. When the first arrivals landed at Rouen, they were received with as much rapture, said a French witness, as if they'd come to conduct a service of expiation for Joan of Arc. At Boulogne, others debarked at the foot of a towering column erected in honour of Napoleon, on the spot from which he had planned to launch the invasion of England. Other transports came into Havre, where the French garrison climbed on the roofs of their barracks and cheered wildly as their allies came down the gangplanks in the blazing heat. That evening, to the sound of far-off summer thunder, the sun went down in a blood-red glow. In Brussels next day, the British ally was at last glimpsed, though narrowly. Hugh Gibson, secretary of the American legation, on an errand to the British military attaché, walked into his room unannounced and saw a British officer in field uniform, dirty and unshaven, writing at a desk. Hustled out by the attaché, Gibson asked irreverently if the rest of the British army was hidden in the building. In fact, the location of the British landings was so well kept from the Germans that they were not to know where or when the BEF had arrived until they ran into it at Mons. In England, antipathies among its commanders were coming to the surface. The King, on a visit of inspection, asked Haig, who was an intimate at court, his opinion of Sir John French as commander-in-chief. Haig felt it his duty to reply that, "I had grave doubts whether either his temper was sufficiently even or his military knowledge sufficiently thorough to enable him to be an effective commander." After the King had left, Haig wrote in his diary that Sir John's military ideas during the Boer War had often shocked me, and added his poor opinion of Sir Archibald Murray, an old woman who weakly acquiesces in orders which his better judgment tells him are unsound, in order to avoid scenes with Sir John's temper. Neither, thought Haig, are at all fitted for the appointments which they now hold. Sir John, he told a fellow officer, would not listen to Murray, but will rely on Wilson, which is far worse. Wilson was not a soldier, but a politician, a word which, Haig explained, was synonymous with crooked dealing and wrong values. Unburdening himself of these sentiments, the smooth, polished, immaculate and impeccable Haig, who had friends in all the right quarters, and at 53 a career of unbroken success behind him, was preparing his way to further success ahead. As an officer who during the campaign in the Sudan had included a camel laden with claret in the personal pack train that followed him across the desert, he was accustomed to doing himself well. On August 11, within 3 days of departing for France, Sir John French learned for the first time some interesting facts about the German army. He and General Colwell, Deputy Director of Operations, visited intelligence, whose chief began telling them about the German system of using reserves. "He kept on producing fresh batches of reserve divisions and extra reserve divisions," wrote Colwell, "like a conjurer producing glassfuls of goldfish out of his pocket. He seemed to be doing it on purpose, and felt quite angry with the man." These were the same facts that the Deuxième Bureau, French intelligence, had learned in the spring of 1914, too late to impress the general's staff or change its estimate of the German right wing. They also came too late to change the British mind. For a new idea to penetrate and effect a fundamental change in strategy, as well as in all the infinite physical details of deployment, would have required time, far more time than was left. Next day, the struggle over strategy between Kitchener and the generals was fought out at a final meeting of the council. Besides Kitchener, Sir John French, Murray, Wilson, Huguet, and two other French officers were present. Although Kitchener could not hear, unless with the mind's ear, the exploding shells of the 420s opening the roads through Liège, he asserted that the Germans would be coming through on the far side of the Meuse in great force. With a sweep of his arm, he indicated the German enveloping movement on a huge war map. "If the BEF concentrated at Maubeuge," he argued, "it would be swamped before it was ready for battle and be forced into a retreat which would be disastrous for its morale in its first encounter with a European enemy since the Crimea." He insisted on a base further back at Amiens to allow freedom of action. His six opponents, the three English and three French officers, were equally adamant on keeping to the original plan. Sir John French, coached by Wilson since his own suggestion of a shift to Antwerp, now protested that any change would upset the French plan of campaign, and remained determined to go forward to Maubeuge. The French officers emphasized the necessity of filling in the left end of their line. Wilson inwardly raged at the cowardice of concentrating at Amiens. Kitchener said the French plan of campaign was dangerous, that instead of taking the offensive, to which he was entirely opposed, they should wait to counter a German attack. For 3 hours the wrangle continued, until Kitchener, unconvinced, was gradually forced to give way. The plan had been in existence, and he had known and fundamentally disapproved of it for 5 years. Now, with the troops already on the water, it had to be accepted, because there was no time to make another. In a last futile gesture, or a calculated gesture to absolve himself of responsibility, Kitchener, bringing Sir John French along with him, took the issue to the Prime Minister. Knowing nothing at all about it, as Wilson confided to his diary, Asquith did what might be expected, presented with Kitchener's views as against the expert and united opinion of the combined general staffs, he accepted the latter. Reduced to 4 instead of 6 divisions, the BEF went forward as arranged. The momentum of predetermined plans had scored another victory. Kitchener, nevertheless, unlike the French and German ministers of war, retained direction of his country's military effort, and the instructions he now issued to Sir John French for the conduct of the BEF in France reflected his desire to limit its liability in the early stages of the war. Like Churchill, who, looking ahead to the vast task of the British Navy, had ordered the Mediterranean fleet both to engage the Goeben and avoid engaging superior forces, Kitchener, looking ahead to the army of millions he had to build, assigned a policy and a mission to the BEF irreconcilable with each other. "The special motive of the force under your control," he wrote, "is to support and cooperate with the French army and to assist the French in preventing or repelling the invasion by Germany of French or Belgian territory." With a certain optimism, he added, "and eventually to restore the neutrality of Belgium," a project comparable to restoring virginity. "As the numerical strength of the British force and its contingent reinforcement is strictly limited, and keeping this consideration steadily in view, it will be necessary to exercise the greatest care towards a minimum of loss and wastage." Reflecting Kitchener's disapproval of French offensive strategy, his order stated that if asked to participate in any forward movements in which the French were not engaged in large numbers and in which the British might be unduly exposed to attack, Sir John was to consult his government first and must distinctly understand that your command is an entirely independent one and that you will in no case come in any sense under the orders of any allied general. Nothing could be more unequivocal. At one stroke, Kitchener had cancelled the principle of unity of command. His motive was to preserve the British army as a nucleus for the future. The effect, given a captain of Sir John's temperament, was practically to nullify the order to support and cooperate with the French. It was to haunt the Allied war effort long after Sir John was replaced and Kitchener himself was dead. On August 14, Sir John French, Murray, Wilson and a staff officer, encouragingly named Major Sir Hereward Wake, arrived at Amiens, where the British troops detrained for further advance to the concentration area around Le Cateau and Maubeuge. On that day, as they began moving up, Kluck's army began moving down from Liège. The BEF, marching cheerfully up the roads to Le Cateau and Mons, were greeted enthusiastically along the way with cries of "Vive les Anglais!" The happiness of the welcome gave point to Lord Kitchener's dampening notice to his troops that they might expect to find temptations both in wine and women which they must entirely resist. The farther north the British marched, the greater was the enthusiasm. They were kissed and decked with flowers, tables of food and drink were set out, and all British offers of pay refused. A red tablecloth with bands of white sewn on it to form the St. Andrew's Cross of the Union Jack was flung over a balustrade. The soldiers tossed their regimental badges, caps and belts to smiling girls and other admirers who begged for souvenirs. Soon the British army was marching with peasants' tweed caps on their heads and their trousers held up by string. "All along the way," wrote a cavalry officer afterward, "we were fêted and cheered by the people who were soon to see our backs." Looking back on it, he remembered the advance of the BEF to Mons as Roses all the way. Chapter 13. Sambre et Meuse. On the Western Front, the 15th day brought an end to the period of concentration and preliminary attacks. The period of offensive battle began. The French right wing, opening the offensive into German-occupied Lorraine, took an old embattled path like so many in France and Belgium, where century after century, whatever the power that makes men fight, brought legions tramping down the same roads, levelling the same villages. On the road east from Nancy, the French passed a stone marker inscribed, "Here, in the year 362, Jovinus defeated the Teutonic hordes." While on the far right, the army of General Po renewed the offensive in Alsace, the first and second armies of Generals Dubai and de Castelnau marched through two natural corridors in Lorraine, which determined the French line of attack. One led towards Sarrebourg, objective of Dubai's army, the other, descending from the ring of hills around Nancy, called the Grande Couronne, led via Chateau Salin into a valley terminating in the natural fortress of Morhange, object of de Castelnau's army. The Germans had prepared the region against expected French attack with barbed wire, trenches and gun emplacements. At both Sarrebourg and Morhange, they had well-fortified positions from which they could only be dislodged by an attack of irresistible élan or bombarded by heavy artillery. The French counted on the first and scorned the second. "Thank God we don't have any," replied a general staff artillery officer in 1909, when questioned about 105mm heavy field artillery. "What gives the French army its force is the lightness of its cannon." In 1911, the War Council proposed to add 105s to the French army, but the artillerymen themselves, faithful to the famous French 75s, remained unalterably opposed. They despised the heavy field cannon as drags upon the mobility of the French offensive, and regarded them, like machine guns, as defensive weapons. Messimy, as war minister, and General Dubai, then on the general staff, had forced through an appropriation for several batteries of 105s. But through changes of government and the continued contempt of the artillery corps, by 1914 only a few had been incorporated into the French army. On the German side, the Lorraine front was held by the 6th Army of Ruprecht, Crown Prince of Bavaria, and by the 7th Army of General von Heringen, which on August 9 was placed under Prince Ruprecht's orders. Ruprecht's mission was to hold as many French troops on his front as possible in order to keep them away from the main front opposite the German right wing. He was to accomplish this, according to Schlieffen's strategy, by falling back and drawing the French forward into a sack, where, having lengthened their line of communications, they could be engaged in battle while the decision took place elsewhere. The essence of the plan was to let the enemy in this sector come on, as he showed every disposition to do, and while tempting him into a tactical victory, inflict upon him a strategic defeat. Like the plan for East Prussia, this strategy involved psychological dangers. In the hour when the trumpet sounded, when his fellow commanders were advancing to victory, it required Ruprecht to accept obediently the necessity of withdrawal. Not a pleasing prospect to a vigorous commander with an appetite for glory, especially not to one of semi-royal rank. Erect and good-looking in a disciplined way, with straightforward eyes and a sensible moustache, Ruprecht had no touch about him of his capricious predecessors, the two King Ludwigs of Bavaria, whose several and excessive passions, one for Lola Montez and the other for Richard Wagner, had caused one king to be deposed and the other to be declared mad. He came, in fact, from a less eccentric branch of the family, which had provided the regent for the mad king, and as a direct descendant of Henrietta, daughter of Charles I of England, was legitimist Stuart heir to the English throne. In memory of King Charles, white roses decorated the palace of Bavaria every year on the anniversary of the regicide. Ruprecht had a more current allied connection in the person of his wife's sister Elizabeth, who was married to King Albert of Belgium. The Bavarian army, however, was thoroughly German. "They were barbarians," reported General Dubai after the first days of battle, who, before evacuating a town, sacked the houses in which they had been billeted, ripped up the chairs and mattresses, scattered the contents of closets, tore down curtains, smashed and trampled furniture, ornaments and utensils. These, however, were as yet only the habits of troops sullenly retiring. Lorraine was to see worse. For the first 4 days of Dubai's and Castelnau's offensive, the Germans retired